You're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa and beyond. Grassroots, community-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa on this lovely sunny day in August. It feels more like October.
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful. Oh.
And this is Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn.
Good afternoon, everyone, and if you're listening on Monday, it's good morning.
That's true, and we hope it's as beautiful a day on Monday. These shows are normally rebroadcast the following Monday morning, but occasionally we rebroadcast again or at different times, so it may be that you're listening. When we're talking about things that are today, it may not be your today when you're listening to
right,
this.
Right, right. Yeah,
that's right. And you can always catch, if you miss both any of the on-air broadcasts, you can always check our archives at KRUUFM.com and at writersvoices.com for shows that you may have missed. And we have a guest today who has a lot to tell aspiring authors.
Oh my.
And published authors.
Yes.
Because he is the expert on book marketing. He's the author of
1001 Ways to Market Your Books, and he has 6 editions of this book?
Right.
Okay.
Right. I attended a workshop with John Kramer probably 20 years ago and got the 3rd edition of his book then, and now he's up to edition 6, so we'll be talking about some of the changes over those years. And John's also a former Fairfielder, now living in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And he's the webmaster at bookmarket.com and bestsellers.com. Welcome to Writers' Voices, John.
Hi, Monica.
Do you remember me?
Very vaguely. I've done a lot of speaking in between that time.
Yeah, that is true. I shouldn't have put you on the spot there. So tell us how you got started in this field, marketing books.
I got started because I was a frustrated author waiting for, you know, a big New York publisher to pick me up. So I started to self-publish books, and in the process of doing that, I had to find out how to go about marketing it. And, you know, this was back, gosh, almost 30 years now. And there just wasn't any information out there on marketing books, so I started creating it because people asked for it.
Well, self-publishing wasn't even that popular back then, was it?
Creating like that, and I was one of the first to ever do that.
Yeah.
People started sharing their stories with me, so the book that you see kept getting bigger and bigger. It started off as 101 ways to market your books and grew into 1001 ways.
Seriously, I did not know that.
Wow.
So what type of books were you self-publishing?
Well, that's an odd little question there, because I started off actually publishing a directory of book printers because I needed it. The book I was planning to publish was one I published about 15 years later called Turntable Illusions, which was a collection of black and white patterns, and when you put them on a record turntable and spin them, they create illusions.
Oh, cool. Of course, not too many people have turntables anymore.
No, in fact, they didn't when I finally got the book out either. One of the techniques I used, as I said, this is 101 uses for an obsolete turntable.
Very good, very good. I still have a turntable, actually.
But I really had to fight with bookstores because bookstores kept saying, no, nobody has turntables anymore. Except in my experience, most people still had their turntables.
Right, they just weren't using them.
Yeah.
I still have one. I don't know the last time I tried to play something on it.
Well, now you can play black and white patterns and go crazy.
Wow. That's really fascinating. So was that the book that you wanted to publish that led to 1001 Ways to Market Your Books? Or was there something else, too?
No, that was the one I was originally planning to self-publish. And in the process, I got into all this information on how to publish, and I found out that there just wasn't useful books out there other than Dan Pointer's self-publishing manual. So I created the directory of book printers, and then I created a book of forms to help you put together your marketing plan. And then, of course, everybody said, well, I've got all these books. What do I do with them? And I said, I know at least 101 ways. Well, I created that book. I had been working with a friend of mine in the toy and gift field, helping him with his marketing. And so that's why I knew about marketing, and I felt confident writing a book about it.
Wow. Now, so it started out 101 ways to market your books. By the third edition, you were 1,001 ways.
Yes, and that all happened in Fairfield.
That all happened in Fairfield. And then what's happened since?
Well, it just keeps growing to 1,001.
But I imagine the 1,001 are a little different.
I had to take a couple chapters out of the book and put them online because they didn't fit any longer. So I actually took out about 120 pages and put them online so that I could keep the book at 700 pages.
And why was that? Why is it important to keep it?
I did a survey of my customers, and they said, I don't want anything bigger than 700 pages.
Now, the version that I have is 427 pages plus an index, so total 450 approximately. So it grew after that, apparently.
It did. Yeah. That's why it's gone through the six editions. And I think the fifth and the sixth were both 704 pages, but the sixth edition only stayed that by me dropping out chapters.
Ah. And when did you publish the sixth edition?
The sixth edition was originally published in 2006, and then I did an update in 2008.
And are you planning another update?
101 Ways was done in 1986.
Wow. Are you planning any further updates? Or new editions?
I don't know. I'm still sort of reluctant to do it. First of all, because it's a big project, I would actually literally have to rewrite the book from start to finish.
Yeah. Yeah.
I know it's my signature book. But right now I'm working on a series of e-books that cover a lot of those topics but would be shorter books. And in today's world, I'm not sure that I could sell a 700-page book again.
Mm. But you're still selling this
one. You know, they're looking for the short e-books, the short books, the 120-page book, 160-page book.
Right.
It's much tougher, unless you're writing fantasy novels, to go 700.
True. True.
Wow. Well, tell us about some of the things that changed between, let's say, this third edition and your sixth edition, not just in the form of the book, but the actual content. Have things, what has changed about how to market books in the last 20 years?
Well, the key thing, of course, is the internet happened.
Right.
And all the things that happened there. Of course, also as part of that is the whole ebook phenomenon and the whole print-on-demand phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
which allows people to publish books for almost no money. And that means that the number of people that are publishing books has, I don't know, it's magnified a lot. It used to be that you'd get about 60,000 books published a year. Now I've seen indications that something like 3 million books are being published every year.
Wow.
I did not realize it was that much. Now, is that...
Well, exponentially because of, especially because of Kindle and Kindle e-books.
Right.
So easy to produce. I mean, there's a Kindle e-book that I saw the other day called 1,000 Words on Marketing.
1,000 words.
That was it. I mean, it's basically 1,000 words. It was like 6 pages. The guy sold it for 99 cents, but it was counted as a book.
Oh, my.
Hmm.
So this 3 million number counts things that are not in print form, only that are just digital.
And so on.
Yeah.
And again, with print on demand, that also has been a big factor in giving authors the power to publish a book even if the book isn't ready for publication.
That is the drawback, isn't it?
Well, it's what's causing confusion in the marketplace for readers, because they're having to go, and it's becoming more and more that books sell because other people recommend it.
Right.
It's always been that way. 80% of all books sell because somebody tells somebody else, you got to read this book. Word of mouth is really important, but it's become crucial in today's world because there are so many really bad books out there. But the neat thing is that there are also a lot of good books getting out that would never have been published in the old days because they didn't have a big enough market.
Right. So
it doesn't matter, because as an author, you can publish even if you only have 5 potential readers, because those 5 you can reach and they buy the book and you're happy and they're happy.
So, John, does this pose a dilemma for you if someone, you know, hires you or utilizes your services or reads your book, and to market a book that you don't think is any good? Or not any good, but you don't think is ready for publication, let's put it that way.
Well, I've actually done consulting on a number of those kinds of books, and in most cases I tell them it's not ready for prime time. But if they still want to go ahead, I try to do the best I can within the context. But the reality is that if the book isn't good, then word of mouth doesn't happen, and that means that ultimately a lot of things don't happen in terms of selling books, because nobody's talking about it, and nobody will.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I would guess that there's probably something like 500 or 1,000 books every year about people getting messages from God that they need to pass on to humanity.
That's probably true.
I mean, there were something like 10 or 20 published back in the old days when you had to actually print a real book. And it, you know, you spent $10,000, which wasn't unusual, you know, to produce a book and get it a good cover and editor, you know, a good editor and so on.
Right.
But nowadays, everybody's got a message from God, or from the Archangel Michael, or you know.
Right. Right.
It's incredible how many books, and certainly a good number of them pass across my desk in one way or another. But the thing is that, you know, it's neat that God's trying to reach us in that many ways.
That is true. And like you said, there might be, each one might be just the right message for a handful of people.
Right. And the thing is that, you know, you can't reject a book because of that. But there are a lot of bad novels out there. I mean, really bad. I mean, even worse than Bridges of Madison County. I mean, 2 of the best-selling novels of the past 20 years are 2 of the worst-written novels of the last 20 years. One was Bridges of Madison County, which, you know, you live in Iowa, and you know that no self-respecting Iowa farmer would go to the Illinois State Fair.
Well, that's true.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, novel had a big problem right there. And then
good.
The Da Vinci Code was a very poorly written novel, but it had an idea behind it that sparked people's imagination. Just as Bridges of Madison County made people cry.
Yeah.
You know, and so it worked, and it was on, you know, it was at the top of the bestseller list for 2 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And, but, you know, not that well written compared to thousands of other romance novels that are incredible. Just like the Da Vinci Code, there are thousands of thrillers that were much better written. But, again, he tapped into people's fascination with the beginning of Christianity.
Right.
And that's why sometimes you can't say a book is good or bad because of how well it's written. Will it capture people's imagination? Will it get word of mouth? If it does that, it's going to be successful, no matter how you compare it to something else that's better.
That's a very good point. And there's a lot of best-selling books that aren't really very well written. And sometimes...
Oh, and then you got all the celebrity bestsellers. And
I
guarantee you that 9 times out of 10, a book written by a celebrity is not going to be as good as a book written by a real writer.
Right.
Well, some of them have help, don't they? Use ghostwriters.
Use ghostwriters.
Yeah.
A lot of them use ghostwriters, but they're still you know, it's not quite the same thing as somebody who's really done research and built up a book. Not to say that celebrities are, you know, terrible. I mean, there's certainly some great books by celebrities, you know, so you can't rule it out, but gosh, there are a lot of really, really good books not being published because, or at least not being published by the big publishers, because the big publishers are focused on celebrities.
On celebrities and on the known names. You know, so it's the suspense, the legal thrillers are John Grisham and, you know, a few others, and the romance novelists, and, you know, you have the same names over and over again.
Yes, but the neat thing is that in today's world, you know, a drugstore worker in Austin, Minnesota, can become a bestseller on Kindle and then get a $2 million contract from a major New York publisher after she sold a million copies.
I know. Now, what is it that, you know, why would somebody who has been that successful self-publishing, what's the draw for them to go with a major publisher?
Well, in this case, Angela Hawking was her name. She went with a large publisher because she wanted to be in Walmart.
Ah.
And she wanted a physical book being out there, you know, in the stores. And she could not do that. I mean, you can't self-publish a book in today's world and get very good distribution. It's just not a reality. That's one thing that the New York publishers still do better than anybody else, is get the book into stores. And she wanted that. She wanted to be in Walmart. She wanted to be in all the stores. And so she sold to them for $2 million. Now, on the other side, there are a number of best-selling authors who have said, I'm only publishing Kindle from now on because I can make more money.
Right.
And the reality is that you probably can make more money by just self-publishing, because, you know, the big publishers are giving you 10% of retail, if you're lucky, and they've been cutting that percentage over the years. And even only 10% of the ebook revenue, whereas if you were self-publishing on Amazon, you could make 70%.
Yeah, I can understand 10% of a physical book, because there's a lot involved in the cost of printing and the inventory and the distribution costs. But
bookstores and all that.
Right.
10% makes you know, good sense. But unfortunately, publishers have gone to 6 or 8% in many cases now.
But for an ebook, you don't have all that overhead.
No, in fact, you have no overhead other than the marketing cost.
Right. So it
and a little bit of development cost or formatting cost.
Well, do you think that the publishers are going to wake up and realize they're going to lose their best producers if they don't pay more for the ebooks?
Well, they're starting to do things like that. In fact, Random House and Putnam, which just merged, they bought the top print-on-demand publisher out there, iUniverse.
Ah.
And they, you know, now are offering to self-publish everybody, you know, through their, you know, those print-on-demand divisions that they have now.
And they'll pay the authors more?
No.
No.
And they won't do any marketing. It's really a bad deal for authors. It's the same thing. There's, you know, Hay House, which is a top spiritual book publisher, now has a division called Balboa Press, which does print-on-demand only. And everybody thinks, wow, I'll be published by Hay House through their Balboa Press imprint, and they're going to sell a ton of books. But the reality is all they're doing is providing a print-on-demand service at a higher cost than what you could do yourself. And they're not giving the distribution to the authors. So, bad deal.
Now, do you think, though, for, let's say, someone who is looking for that book, or looking for books and browsing for books, or libraries, for example, are they going to be more likely to look at the ones that are published by Balboa than from a unknown publishing company?
I don't think so, because if Hay House were doing a real editorial process and not just taking the money and run, yes, then libraries and bookstores would say, okay, this is a book curated by Hay House.
Right.
But they're not doing that. They're just taking the money and running.
Oh.
They're basically telling the authors that aren't good enough to be in their publishing program, here's an option.
Ha ha. Okay.
And so everybody knows that, well, these are the second-rate titles from Hay House. These are ones they rejected.
Well, that's not very good.
Because Hay House, if they knew it was a good book, they would be
they
publishing
would be publishing
it. They would be tying that author down to a contract.
They're
saying, pay us money and we'll publish through Balboa. Mm.
Is it often that publishers think that a book is going to really be hot and then it falls flat? Does that happen very often?
Well, 3 out of 4 books published by New York publishers are failures.
Wow.
Wow.
And they think all of them are winners, or they wouldn't have.
Oh, my.
Because they're, wow.
Not necessarily. All publishers categorize their books as A, B, and C. A is the books that's going to get all the money that they're going to promote. They think they're going to be bestsellers. B means that they think it's got a chance, but they're not going to put a lot of money into it. And C are books that they're just throwing out there to see what happens.
Why do they even bother with the C's if they don't believe in them?
Mainly to complete their title, you know, their catalog, to have the books in the different fields that they want them in, things like that. But, you know, the Publishers Weekly, the magazine for the U.S. publishing industry, every year does a case history of all the New York publishers and books they expected to do well that did not do well. And the reality is that even with the A-list books, 3 out of 4 books fail.
Wow. And with the C-list, is it the same proportions? Do 1 out of 4 of the C-list succeed?
It's worse.
Oh, wow.
And B, the same, because they don't spend the time to market them. They do worse covers on them and things like that. I mean, a good bookseller can spot from a New York publisher whether it's an A, B, or C title by the look of the book cover.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, you'd think you would give it your best shot on that level anyway.
Yes, but book covers are expensive, and they just don't spend the same amount of time, you know.
Right, right.
Looking at the cover, replaying with it, and things like that. So it's really amazing. I mean, there was a story about 4 or 5 years ago of a New York publisher that brought out this novel that Stephen King said was one of the best novels ever. But they brought it out with a really bad title. And the fact of the matter is that in their conferences, they did not call it by the title. They always referred to it as the office novel. I mean, the title was so bad they couldn't remember it. Chance that anybody, the word of mouth would happen.
Wow.
Such a bad title on the book.
So why didn't it occur to someone to change the title?
I don't know.
Wow.
But Stephen King and somebody else wrote about that because they both had fallen in love with the novel, and they were going, this is crazy. We're convinced this book should have been a bestseller.
Wow.
It just was stuck with a bad title. And I don't remember the title, so I remember it by the publisher's title, The Office Novel.
I bet if we Googled Stephen King, The Office Novel, we'd probably be able to find it. Hey, you're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Kramer, the author of 1001 Ways to Market Your Books and many other books and ebooks on marketing books and creating bestsellers. So, John, how important is the cover in selling your book, marketing your book?
Well, it's obviously very important, as I've been telling you, that it really does make a difference in terms of whether or not people pass it on and talk about it and things like that. And that really requires that the book look right. I mean, even consumers, while they may not be able to say, hey, this cover is bad, somewhere in the back of their mind they're going, nah, I think I'll take this book over here.
Mm-hmm.
More confidence in it. And the look and feel of a cover really does say something about the, you know, does the publisher really rely on this book? And I've sat on panels with top producers from TV shows and book reviewers and book buyers at Barnes & Noble, and the first thing they do, they don't open the book, they don't look at the back cover, they look at the front cover, and in many cases, they just toss the book aside. They say, it's not worth even opening up because we know it's not, the publisher has not put in the effort into the book.
So there's a lot of people judging a book by its cover out there.
You are.
And partly so in the sense that there's, you know, a publisher is basically signaling that this is a book that we haven't put much attention into. We haven't put much effort into editing it, making it a good book, marketing it, et cetera, et cetera. And we're telling you that because the cover is not good enough.
You know, I just, it's just as a business model, it doesn't make sense to me.
I know.
It just seems like they'd be better off publishing fewer books and doing right by every single one.
Right. And, I mean, the whole New York publishing model is broken. That's why
we're
starting to see the mergers of the bigger companies. And what happens whenever a merger happens is that the combined sales of the two companies basically withers, so that if they had combined sold $1 billion a year, they sell, you know, $600 million a year after the merger.
Wow, then why do they keep merging if that
I don't understand it other than get rid of the competition. Literally, I've seen it happen over and over where a company gets bought and disappears. There was a wonderful company, you know, 30 years ago called Prentice Hall that did wonderful business books and books on speaking and books on promotion and things like that. It was bought by Simon & Schuster for like $500 million. And within years, it was totally gone.
Wow.
Most of their titles had, they stopped publishing and they were doing a bad job with the ones they were publishing. I mean, it was miserable, you know, because I was, at the time, I had a bookstore, a catalog of books that I liked to sell from other publishers, and they would change the price of the book every 3 months. I couldn't keep it, I couldn't sell it because I was selling it for a loss eventually.
Wow.
I mean, they just didn't, they treated it as an orphan baby. I don't know why they buy them when they're not going to treat them as a full-blown, hey, we bought something of real value here, let's do something. What they're basically doing is buying a few of the backlist titles and calling it a wash.
Wow. Yeah.
Well, it's going to happen with the Putnam Random House merger. You're going to see imprints disappear. You're going to see, you know, things, the number of books combined that they used to publish is going to be at least, you know, two-thirds of what it was.
You know, back to the issue of the appearance of the book, the look of the book, you know, the cover is part of it, but also the inside of the book and how it's formatted, the type of paper, the print style. I can tell almost unfailingly whether a book is self-published or from a mainstream publisher by that. Sometimes the cover, sometimes the self-published books have decent covers, but rarely is the inside up to par.
They would, the self-publishers have gotten the message that the cover is important. They still haven't gotten the message of how important it is to the look and feel of the book inside. And it's something I've been trying to teach them for almost like 15 years, but it just goes over their head.
Well, I will say that when I get a submission for someone who wants to be on the show, that influences me.
It does, and it's the reason that, you know, once even a reader gets past that front cover, they see the inside, and it looks amateurish if it doesn't facilitate them reading the book, which is what good design does, they won't buy the book, especially if they're browsing through bookstores. Now, if they buy online, they don't know what it looks like inside.
Right.
But I guarantee you that if they get it at home, one, they either won't read the book or complete the book, or two, they won't pass it on to other people.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. That it really is.
So it's so crucial that the inside also be professional.
Now, John, when you're advising people on marketing books, is the advice the same for someone who's self-published as someone who's published by a mainstream publisher?
No. Because I know that if they're published by a mainstream publisher, they have distribution.
Mm.
So the whole process of what they can do changes, because once it's in all the bookstores, they have a much easier chance of, say, getting on TV, because national TV doesn't want to promote a book that isn't available to their audience.
True.
And so if you don't have good bookstore distribution, I mean, Oprah only picked books from larger publishers because she knew that they would have the distribution, and 95% of the books that her Oprah Book Club sold were bought in bookstores. I don't know why it was, you know. Here you have, you know, BoobTube fanatics sitting there on their couch watching a TV show and going out to the bookstore to buy the book.
Rather than ordering it
from Amazon,
like,
yeah. That. I mean, it was an amazing phenomenon, but 90 to 95% of the titles that she selected were sold to bookstores.
Wow. So bookstores still have an important role to play.
I do think they do, and the good ones are going to survive. But there are a lot of bad bookstores, poorly run, poorly building a relationship with the community, that don't survive. But it's amazing. There's still new bookstores being founded every week. And I love that they have that optimism. I think that if you do the right job, if you make yourself a community center, then people come to buy books.
Right.
Don't. If you fail in that process, then you're going to lose, because people are going to go to Amazon.
Right. Yeah. How can the independent bookstores, or even the chain bookstores, capture some of the e-book market? Is that starting to happen?
They are. In fact, I've just been doing a review of a lot of bookstore websites, and one of the commonalities that I saw in a lot of them is that they're promoting Kobo ebooks. Kobo has a partnership with the American Booksellers Association to make ebooks available through their member websites.
And is that.
Now you're going, what's Kobo?
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, know what Kobo is compared to Nook or Kindle. It's certainly, you know, third or fourth run. But it does give the opportunity to the independent booksellers to get into the e-book market without supporting Barnes & Noble, which is behind Nook, or Amazon, which is behind Kindle.
Okay. And now, could a book in a Kobo format be read on one of those other devices, or is there no cross-platform compatibility?
There's no cross-platform, but I believe Nook and Kobo books are both EPUB formatted, so they probably could read them.
Mm.
And even, I believe, now with Kindle having internet access, that you could probably get a Kobo reader that you could use to even read Kobo ebooks on your Kindle.
Oh, interesting. You know, the local libraries here in Iowa offer ebooks, and I've tried, or I have read them or done a couple, but it's kind of complicated, and they have very limited numbers of copies of them, and you have to wait a really, really long time to get it, because all the libraries in the state are sharing the same six copies of the bestseller or whatever.
Wow.
So.
And they do limit how many can be out at the same time.
Right.
I just read an article, I think it was yesterday, that said that e-book sales are falling back from what they used to be. One of the problems is that so many people have a tablet computer and do not want to read e-books on a tablet computer.
Hmm. Why not? What's wrong with reading them on a tablet?
Didn't say why. They haven't figured that out yet.
Oh, interesting.
But it does make a problem, you know, that you thought that the tablets would actually open up the e-book market, but they seem to be actually diminishing the e-book market.
Well, I can kind of, you know, thinking about this, you know, I have a Kindle, and it's comfortable to hold and read the Kindle, but a tablet is not quite as comfortable to hold.
I was going to say, it's the actual process of reading it that's doing it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the reading experience is different.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there's a good reason to still have a dedicated e-book reader.
Yes.
But the tablets are forcing people to make a choice. Do I buy the tablet or do I buy an e-book reader?
Right.
People can't afford both, and so they buy the tablet. But then they find that it's not that easy to buy or read books on the tablet as compared to a Kindle or a Nook.
Hmm.
Everything's changing all the time, that's for sure.
It is. I mean, it's really, you know, it took a long time for the New York publishers to realize that there was a market in e-books.
So
for a long time, they just didn't get it, and they're still not understanding that they have to offer authors a better deal than what they've been doing.
And we do hear a lot that the big publishers and small publishers, too, for that matter, don't really offer very much marketing support for most books that they print.
One reason that my book sells so well is because all the authors are buying it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But they need to. They realize that the only way they're going to sell the book is they can't rely on the publisher. Again, especially when the publisher is judging the success or failure of the book. New York publishers give a book about 6 weeks lifespan.
Whoa.
And if it hasn't taken off and sold and continued to sell, it's dropped.
Wow.
And quite honestly, it's more like a 2 week lifespan in reality. The book doesn't take off. If the author doesn't get radio shows, if they don't get on TV and so on, the publisher drops support. There was a classic case of that with a book that became a bestseller ultimately, but started off as it was a book called Calinetics. But it was brought out at the same time as and it was a fitness book. It was brought out at the same time as a fitness book by Victoria Principal, star of TV and movies.
Oh, yes.
And so Victoria Principal, of course, got all the TV, got all the radio, got all the play in the major newspapers. And Callan Pinkney, although she was published by a major New York publisher, got nothing. They dropped it.
Mm.
And Callan, the book Calinetics, only became a bestseller 10 months later when a reader in Naperville, a housewife in Naperville, Illinois, tracked down the author and said, "When are you coming to Chicago? I love your book. It's changed my life." Helen said, "Well, as soon as, you know, if there's a TV station that invites me to come, I will come." And the housewife in Naperville, Illinois, called back an hour later and said, "I got you on TV. I'll pick you up at the airport." Turned out that Callan Pinkney was a really good TV guest. She just hadn't been given the chance. So she started playing, you know, she started going to Dayton and Indianapolis and all these Midwest cities, eventually made it to New York City, eventually made it on Oprah. The book became a bestseller. All the way along, she had a fight with her publisher to get books into the bookstores because she knew they had 10,000 copies sitting in the warehouse.
Wow.
And so the publisher, despite their worst efforts, had a bestseller. All because of, not the author, but a housewife in Naperville, Illinois.
And what happened to her? Did she become a book marketer?
I have no idea. I never caught her name because I would definitely have her on a list for every author to pick, you know, to contact.
Yeah, really?
That's a really interesting story. I would have thought that the publishers would have wakened up to this thing with the e-books sooner. I'm surprised that they were so...
You know, the New York publishers are so good at getting books into bookstores and, you know, getting a certain amount of media attention that they really do what they do best. And they don't do any of the other stuff. And so they still are not the best online marketers in the world.
Yeah.
So it really does sound like for a major, you know, like a New York publisher... The advantage of being published by them is maybe not financial, maybe not marketing support, but it is distribution. That is the for a new author. That
really
would be the
advantage. It really does make a difference, especially if you're trying to be a bestseller.
Yeah,
there have been self-published books and books from small publishers that have hit the bestseller list, but 95% of the books on the bestseller list are published by the New York publishers.
Hmm.
That's what they do well.
Right.
Again, they don't do it well for that many of their books, but they do it well enough that it still is the dream of an author to be published by a New York publisher.
Absolutely. So. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is John Kramer, the author of 1001 Ways to Market Your Books for Authors and Publishers. So we also hear a lot that publishers, both New York publishers and small press, are, when they're making the decision of who to publish, they're looking for how much marketing the author is willing to do, how much of a platform they have already established for selling books. Do you want to address that?
Well, yes, it's very crucial. I was talking to the publisher at New World Library. It's a good publisher of spiritual titles. And he said, I can't publish a book I love anymore. I have to take it to the editorial meeting, and the author has to have a platform. And if they don't have a platform, and the platform is essentially a ready-made audience, whether it's online or offline, if they have a popular radio show, if they have a newspaper column, if they write for a major magazine, if they've got a high-traffic blog, then the publisher can publish them because they have a platform. Without that, it's much tougher to make that choice and decide that, yes, I can publish.
Right. And so is part of your job helping people build that platform?
Yes. In fact, I tell authors that their job is essentially to jumpstart the word of mouth for a book, for their book. And everything that I work with them is to help them to jumpstart that word-of-mouth marketing. Now, for many books, that means that the author has to get out there and speak and do all kinds of speaking. Because if you look at the bestsellers in the last 20 years in religion, business, self-help, romance, spiritual books, any those categories, it all depends on if the author is a speaker or not. Are they out there going to the Unity churches? Are they out there speaking in businesses? Are they out there speaking at conventions? If they are, the book has a chance to be a bestseller. If the author isn't out there speaking, the books in those categories rarely become bestsellers.
So sometimes it seems like people who are speakers in those areas, they write the book really to support their speaking career.
Yes.
And the speaking career supports the book sales.
Yes. In fact, most speakers talk about the book as just being a larger business card.
Ah, yeah. That makes sense.
Of course, not all...
I have one consulting client published by John Wiley in New York, and he buys thousands of copies from them every year simply to give away to potential clients because he makes so much money on his financial consulting practice that he can afford to give the books away like they're candy.
Whoa.
Of course, not everybody...
That's because he says, this is my business card. This is where I'll get the clients, and the client is worth $1,000 or $2,000 a year.
Okay. Oh, absolutely, yeah.
The problem is not everybody is a speaker.
In the same way, so, and it becomes very much a business card. That's one reason you really like to have a print book and not just an e-book. Because an e-book you can't give away as a business card. It doesn't work.
Right.
But what about authors who aren't good public speakers?
Then they don't write in those fields.
Ah. Okay.
No, the neat thing now with the Internet is that the Internet has opened the doors for people that don't like to speak, that don't like to even do, say, a live interview like that, like this. They will in turn become an internet marketer and write articles for top, high traffic websites and things like that. And that way they can still get, good enough traffic and a good enough platform that they can sell books. And so there's a whole phenomenon on the internet called a blog tour or a virtual book tour, where authors can appear on different blogs and websites and generate a lot of interest in a small period of time for their book.
So what is the role of agents in today's publishing world? Isn't the agent...
They're still important to reach New York publishers.
Mm. Okay.
New York publishers now basically have cut their editorial staff by a lot. they're using agents as their editors.
Oh.
And so they will only accept solicitations from agents, and so then they use the agent as their pre-screener for the good books rather than having, you know, 10 other editors on their staff.
Hmm.
So it's interesting because...
Not them anything to use the agent because the agent gets their cut of the action from the author.
Ah, yeah.
So the author has been getting squeezed over the past 30 years because the agent's fees have increased. They used to be universally 10%, but I've seen agents do 12 or 15% nowadays. And the publisher, because they're having to give bigger discounts to Amazon and so on, and bookstores are demanding higher discounts, they're taking that discount that they're giving to the bookstores and they're taking it from the author. That's why the author is getting, on average now, probably 8% rather than 10%.
Well, it seems like the...
And it used to be that it was 10% of the retail price. Now it's often 10% of the net price.
Oh, interesting.
And the net price is what the publisher gets from the, you know, the wholesaler, the bookstore, and so on. And that's often half of what the retail price is.
Yeah.
I know of an author that had a contract with one of the big New York publishers, and they became a New York Times bestseller, but he saw no money other than his advance from the book because the publisher basically netted away all the other money that he had potentially made because they assigned all kinds of expenses to that book compared to other books, et cetera, et cetera. And he ended up not making a dime over and above his advance.
Well, that doesn't sound fair to me.
It isn't. And that's why you have to be very careful if you sign a contract that says net, that you really have to define what net is so that they're not nickel and diming you to death to the point where you don't get any more, you know, you get your advance and nothing else.
Well, John, what are some of the ways in which you work with them?
It's also not getting the advances they used to get. 20 years ago, it wasn't uncommon for a publisher to give a $100,000 advance to a book they expected to be a B-list book.
Wow. What would that author get now?
A lot of A-list titles are getting, you know, $25,000 or less.
Whoa. So, but of course, sometimes getting a big advance worked to someone's detriment because if the book didn't pay off the advance, then they couldn't get published the next time around.
Right. And that was always a problem. If their book did not earn out the advance, they never got a second contract.
Yeah.
Not only from that publisher, but from other New York publishers.
Now, what about, you talk a lot about New York publishers, but do you work with authors from small presses as well?
Yes, and there's some wonderful publishers out there like Hay House and New World Library and Sourcebooks that are not located in New York, but are really top-level, you know, book publishers who have had New York Times bestsellers on their list.
And do they give the same advantages in terms of distribution, or is it not quite as much?
It's not quite as good as a New York publisher, but those publishers that have had a bestseller track record will tend to get more books into the bookstores than the ones who have not had a track record of a bestseller.
Of course, sometimes an unknown press makes a big breakthrough, like with the Chicken Soup books.
Yeah. I love that story.
I know, and that publisher has two jets, all because of Chicken Soup.
I believe it. Yeah, that was...
It wasn't the greatest deal for Jack and Mark, but...
But it was a deal, which they couldn't get from anyone else.
It was, depending on who's telling the story, they contacted somewhere between 50 and 144 publishers. Before they found, Health Communications and had the book, And I'm looking at, and the reason their book was rejected is because all publishers know that short stories don't sell.
Yeah. Well.
And who would want to read about,
what the
that?
Publishers weren't looking at is that this is a book written by 100 speakers So you not only had the platform of Jack and Mark, but you had the platform of the other 98 authors
right.
who were all speakers out there on the national campaign, you know, that were going to market the book as well.
Yeah.
That should have been obvious.
It should have been obvious, but obviously it wasn't.
Obviously it wasn't.
And they had a literary agent that took it to like 30 publishers, and they all rejected it. Mm-hmm. And then they started, you know, submitting it on their own because right. the agent said, I can't do it for you.
Now, agents, it seems like, are sort of the filter to the publishers. And the publisher, you used the word earlier in the hour, that they are almost, their role is almost as a curator.
Yes.
And for the reader, so it's been through several levels of people signing on and believing in this book, so you have some confidence that it's going to be a good book when you put your money down.
Yes, but you know, it's surprising how poorly all publishers have done in building their brands.
Mm.
You know, there's no publisher that is the Apple of the industry.
Could there be?
There could be. I think there could be, but it would be them making a conscious decision to have enough good editors on their staff that they build a reputation to be the company that really publishes good books.
Are there editors out there working for the New York publishing houses like the Gordon Lishes of old?
I think there still are some, but the reality is, in my experience, that the best editors eventually become agents.
Ah.
Because they can make more money.
Mm. John, tell us a little bit about the different ways that you work with authors.
Well, my primary function with them is, you know, one is I sell them courses on how to market themselves. Two, I do book coaching where I coach people. And some people, you know, I only spend an hour with them. I give them the five best ways to market their books and what they should do, and then they go off and do it. And some, again, hire me more long-term. So I have, like, year-long contracts with some authors to be there for them when they have questions. And I just recently started to do some book promotion services because I found that most authors are lazy, want to do the promotion. So I started offering a few promotional services. One of them is a bookstore campaign where I write the sales copy for them, and I email it to the top 650 independent bookstores.
That would be a valuable service.
I would think.
I've had good response from that. I only started that about 2 or 3 weeks ago, but I've already had a good number of people sign up, and some people that said, I want to do it for every book that you know, my clients publish or something like that. And so that's a good service. Another one that I do is I do this campaign for people so that they raise the Alexa ranking of their website. Alexa ranking is sort of a measure of the traffic to your website.
Mm.
And I've done very well with all my websites. I mean, I've got about, I don't know, 10 or 15 websites in the top 300,000 websites in the world.
Wow.
And, you know, that's not that easy to do, but I know how to do it.
How are some of the ways that you market yourself?
My primary way is very simple, and that's creating relationships with other bloggers and websites and authors who then turn around and do teleseminars with me, Google Hangouts, blog talk radio interviews, and then, of course, doing interviews like I do with you here. So that's my primary way. The other way, of course, is through blogging and the social networks. But I really tell authors that you can't rely on social networks as your marketing tool. And you shouldn't spend more than about 10 or 15 minutes a day on all your social networks.
And why is that?
Because they're a time suck. I know people that, you know, get onto Facebook and then 3 hours later they're going, what did I just do?
Yeah, I have seen that. I don't normally do it myself, but I have seen that happen.
The thing is that social networks are not for socializing. They're really there just to point people to what you've done on your blog, you know, a new post that you've written or something, or a new offer you have for your book, or, you know, an appearance that you're doing on another blog, and so you share it with all your social networks. That's the key. And even beyond that, the one social network that I really like right now is Pinterest. It is driving. I mean, I have one pin that I did that has had over a million views.
Wow.
My gosh.
And, you know, but you can't really measure that on Pinterest. The only way that I know that is because of the amount of traffic it's sending to my website.
Wow. And what did you pin?
Actually, in this case, it was what I call a bookographic. It's an infographic that featured Bob Harper's The Skinny Rules.
Wow.
And it went viral on Pinterest. I mean, people still share it every day and repin it. I still get 200 to 300 visitors to this one website every day of one graphic. And I have another one, something about 15 things to give up if you want to be happy.
Wow.
That has gone viral. It's probably had 500,000 views already.
Well, that's really interesting. So Pinterest is the way to go. So, John, we're out of time. It's amazing how quickly an hour can go when
it
you're talking
is.
About an interesting topic.
Well, you see,
and particularly with the expert, we've been talking with John Kramer, the author of 1001 Ways to Market Your Books for Authors and Publishers, and the webmaster of bookmarket.com and bestseller.com.
It's actually not bestsellers.com. It's bookmarketingbestsellers.com.
Okay, sorry. Bookmarketingbestsellers.com. Great. And before we close for the day, I wanted to put a call out. I've had someone asked me to ask about writers' groups in Fairfield. He's looking to join a writers' group or form a writers' group. So if you are interested, send me an email, show@writersvoices.com, S-H-O-W @writersvoices.com, and we'll try and put interested parties together here in Fairfield.
You were in a writers' group before, weren't you?
Yeah. And actually, we're going to do a show on writers' group sometime this fall.
Oh, good.
On writers' groups.
Good.
So, great.
Good.
And, Mom, you've got some closing words of wisdom for us.
Well, Dave Barry is a humorist. Dave Barry is a very successful author, I would say. I love him. And he says, camping is nature's way of promoting the motel business.
And thanks for joining us today on Writers' Voices. Thanks for being with us, John.
Thank you very much, Monica and Caroline.
Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.